You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. What would you do if your 12-year-old son, who was being bullied at school, came home with a Class C misdemeanor ticket issued by a school police officer? And to resolve the ticket, your son would have to appear in adult criminal court, which could result in fines upwards of $500, community service hours, and behavior management courses. This very thing happened to middle schooler D'Angelo Rollins in 2010 in Bryan, Texas. Bryan, like many school districts, has a substantial history of suspending and arresting black students at a disproportionate rate than their white peers. Now, did you know black students, who make up 16% of enrollment, accounted for 40% of suspensions nationally? The data show that every time a black child is suspended from school, they are put at a much higher risk for dropping out of school and being incarcerated. In her Mother Jones article, Betsy DeVos is making it easier for schools to send black kids like this 13-year-old girl to jail. ProPublica reporter Annie Waldman took an in-depth look at one school district that is emblematic of many school districts across the country that have implemented systemic discriminatory disciplinary action against students of color. That's a mouthful. Annie Waldman, thank you for being here. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, since I didn't throw out enough statistics, I want to throw out one more, and that's: according to federal data, black students are almost four times as likely to receive an out-of-school suspension and twice as likely to be arrested as their white peers. And I want to get to some working definitions here. Mm-hmm. In-school suspension, out-of-school suspension, and juvenile arrest. Define those and put them in the context of school discipline.
For sure. Since the 1990s and since the 1980s, there have been a number of school disciplinary techniques which have proliferated across the United States. For example, you have in-school suspension, which is a little more aggressive than the formal detention or lunchtime detention. That's when you go to a secluded room and you might have no teacher there and you're just forced to work by yourself.
It's like solitary confinement, it sounds.
Exactly. No teachers. You can't talk to other students. And sometimes you're not even allowed to do anything at all in some school districts. Then you have an out-of-school suspension, which is a little more aggressive than that, where you're required to stay home from school. You're not allowed to come back to school. This can be a huge burden for families across America, and it happens quite frequently, hundreds of thousands of out-of-school suspensions a year. And from that, we also have a juvenile law enforcement referral, which means when a school police officer may get involved, they might not arrest a student, but they might have some kind of involvement with bringing them to the police house or something like that. And then you also have juvenile arrest, which is the most aggressive and egregious of juvenile disciplinary procedures, which removes the child not only from the school, but also from their home into a juvenile facility for teenagers that is essentially a jail for kids.
Okay, so then now that we have those definitions, now let's talk about the kinds of behaviors that black students are engaging in that warrants them being suspended, expelled, arrested?
Well, warrant is an interesting word, right? And, you know, there are a number of people who believe that these disciplinary techniques actually do not help students if they have behavioral problems, if they have school acting out problems. But what a lot of people have found just looking at the research, you know, why are these students being sent to jail? Why are these students being suspended? Oftentimes it's for discretionary events, meaning that it might be a child who talks back to a teacher, snaps at a teacher, and then the teacher says, you know what, according to my code of conduct, this is defiance. This is acting out. And they're allowed to discipline students based on these very subjective things.
Wow, discretionary events. So if you just get on the teacher's bad side one day, you could go from sitting in the classroom to starting your journey on what we all now know as the school-to-prison pipeline.
Right. And what is so, what really upsets me as a reporter, and I think a lot of Americans out there, is that implicit bias permeates our educational system. You know, unconscious bias that we don't really see necessarily, or we can't really label as overt discrimination or overt racism, but affects the tiny minor things that we do. I think millennials these days are calling them microaggressions, but they can have devastating effects for families when, you know, a teacher might look at a student a different way who happens to be a student of color versus a white student.
Well, that gets to the whole question of perception. Are black and brown children perceived to be more dangerous than their white peers.
Right. And, you know, there's been a lot of research that says that is indeed the case. I mean, there was a really interesting study by this Columbia professor, Peter Bergstrom, that was recently published. And what the study looked at was integration in a white neighborhood in California. And they bussed in black and Hispanic students. And even though those students who went to this program, their grades went up, they were able to get into more colleges, also, the arrest numbers went up. They were arrested more than in the neighborhoods that they came from. And so what this says to me and really exemplifies is that even if you give students extra educational opportunities, students of color extra educational opportunities, you'll still see the implicit bias that is baked into our system. It's impossible to ignore.
Okay, so then, so this whole thing is just sort of like maddening. But right. Are poor whites subjected to this same kind of sort of overzealous treatment by school officials?
Well, you know, it's hard to really disaggregate those numbers, but what is clear when you look at the federal data is that this is something that disproportionately affects students of color. I mean, even if you look at wealthy students of color versus non-wealthy students, you'll see the same kind of divide. And what's interesting is, in fact, new data published by Betsy DeVos's own education department a couple of weeks ago shows that these disparities are widening. So she has this data at her fingertips and sees that these disparities are widening, yet she's really brought up this conversation about should the Obama-era policies, which tried to ameliorate school discipline issues, should those policies go away?
I mean, is she intentionally engaging in this debate, or because she's trying to dismantle those Obama-era policies, that the debate is being waged simply because of what she's doing?
That's a really good question. I mean, we don't have a lot of evidence to see what she really feels and thinks inside other than a couple confirmation hearings. And
which didn't say much in those hearings.
Right. I mean, there have been some hearings where senators have accused her of literally, quote unquote, not caring about black and brown students, right? Mm-hmm. So there are, these questions have been thrown out there about what does she actually feel about civil rights today and civil rights when it pertains to race in America. But what seems to be the case is that she has initiated a number of listening sessions where she's invited in teachers and families and advocacy groups across America to discuss how should we approach discipline in the era of Trump. And what seems to be clear to at least civil rights advocates is that she intends to roll back a lot of these policies that Obama put in place.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Annie Waldman about her new piece. It's a joint piece, Mother Jones and ProPublica. Betsy DeVos is making it easier for schools to send black kids like this 13-year-old girl to jail. We'll talk about her when we come back from the break. But so we're talking about disciplinary action against students, primarily black and brown students, and they can go from an in-school suspension, out-of-school suspension, juvenile arrest. Teachers have discretionary ways of implementing those things. But then a lot of schools have these school officers, are they school safety officers, right? School police officers? Talk about them and their role in all of this.
Right. So let's go back to the 1980s. This is, you know, a time when the horrific term, quote unquote, super predators came about, and there was this war on drugs. And, you know, schools became very frightened that there would be a juvenile crime wave and that crime from the streets would filter into the schools. And so what happened is that they bolstered their school law enforcement budgets. They start having relationships with police units in cities and school districts around the country, and brought police officers into the classroom, into the hallways. And, you know, after Columbine, that just escalated because a lot of people are very afraid of school shootings. And so they thought if we have police officers in the hallways, that's the only way to actually protect our students against this. But, you know, one effect of that was that these police officers, you know, when they're not necessarily out there protecting students of, you know, for that, they ended up just having greater contact with black and brown students. And the arrest numbers skyrocketed, the suspension numbers skyrocketed, the expulsion numbers skyrocketed. And what you start to see is the school-to-prison pipeline really solidify.
When police are in the schools, who do they report to? Do they report to the precinct, or do they report to the principal?
That's a good question. I mean, it really is a joint relationship. Even though they do report to the precinct and they're under the control of the precinct, they have a very tight bond, I believe, with most administrations of school districts. So they're frequently communicating back and forth about students that they might see as problem students or events that might happen on campus.
I'm glad you brought up the 1980s and the war on drugs and the fear of crime. Because as I was looking through this, I kept thinking, how is it that with the reduction in the rates of crime overall in society and, you know, record lows in all the categories now for almost like two decades, and yet your story is all about how for school children in their arrests and suspensions that they're going through the roof. So how I'm struggling with how is society dealing with the fact that if you're putting cops in schools because you're worried about crime coming into the schools, but crime is low, how does that work?
Right. Well, you know, what also happened over the past decade is this focus on testing, right, and school testing. And, you know, we're judging schools based on how well they're able to do. And so many teachers and administrators began to see students that would act out as problem students and affecting perhaps the top line or bottom line of their test scores. And so that really started to, you know, they started to plan, like, how can we get these students out of the classroom? And there's actually been a proliferation of students being referred to alternative schools or behavioral schools or out of the system because they're so concerned about making sure their test scores are good because that's what they're judged by.
Okay, so we now have perceptions of black and brown kids being dangerous because of subconscious bias, which you have to wonder how subconscious is it if, like, you're a teacher, or you're a principal or an administrator, and you're noticing that, gee, it seems like mostly detention is filled. Well, they don't even do detention anymore, given in school suspension.
They do. It's just not as formal as in school suspension or out of school suspension.
But so then you're an administrator and you're looking at the fact that the folks are black and brown in detention, in school suspension, out of school suspension. It doesn't seem like educators are really motivated to change the problem, or am I being overly harsh in that assessment?
Well, you know, one criticism that I have run up against when I talk to people about this, well, they say, well, what if these students are just acting out more? What if, you know, students of color just act out more? And what I always bring up is there's research that shows that that's not the case, that these students aren't acting out more. In fact, you know, there is something called labeling effect as well, which means that if you start to criminalize kids, if you start to treat them like criminals, eventually, that spirals later and later down the line, and they will act out because they believe that people are mistreating them. And so even though there's no research to show that, you know, on a face-to-face level, base level, that these kids are acting differently, it does actually start to hurt them because it hurts inside of them later on.
I'm going to take this break a little early because I want to dive deep into the children who you write about from Bryan, Texas. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with ProPublica reporter Annie Waldman about her latest investigation titled Betsy DeVos is Making It Easier for Schools to Send Black Kids Like This 13-Year-Old Girl to Jail. It's midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me is Annie Waldman. We're talking about her latest piece for ProPublica and Mother Jones. It's all about Betsy DeVos and children of color and going to jail, and title's long. But but before we get into the 13-year-old girl who's the focus of your piece, Trevasia Jackson, a caller called in before we went to break, and she was questioning whether, if white children are not being disciplined in the same way, are white children not being treated as harshly?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to jump right into the Bryan section of our conversation. But when I was investigating, you know, a specific investigation the Office for Civil Rights did in Bryan, Texas, I actually requested through a public records request all of the documents from the federal investigation. And what I found was that even federal investigators are finding around the country that for the same offense, white students and black students are being treated differently. They're getting different disciplinary reactions. And so, you know, for something like speaking out or defiance, a white student might be set to detention, which is a relatively, you know, it's informal kind of, you know, you sit in the cafeteria during lunch. Whereas a black student will have a full day of in-school suspension, meaning that they're relegated to a seclusion room where they don't have a teacher there or they have no direct one-on-one contact. And so because of these incidents that the Office for Civil Rights is finding around the country, they actually have come out and said that white students are actually getting different discipline for the same offenses as black students.
I still can't get over the fact this in-school detention, every time you mention it, it sounds like solitary confinement in jail. So this, Bryan, Texas, and this was the case of a 13-year-old seventh grader named Travesia Jackson. Tell us her story.
So what brought me to Bryan, Texas was, you know, after Betsy DeVos came in, I wanted to understand on the ground, how are her policies or policy rollbacks, how are they affecting real families, real, you know, families of color around the country? And so I looked around for, you know, a federal investigation that was open under Obama, and I wanted to see what happened to that investigation under Trump. And so in 2013, there was a civil rights investigation that was started in Bryan, Texas. And I hadn't heard anything about it since Trump came into office. Through, you know, sources and putting out public records requests, I found out that this investigation had been closed with no findings, which was alarming to me because I looked at the data for Bryan, Texas. I saw all these anomalies. I saw how black students were disproportionately disciplined, how they were few students and gifted and talented versus the white students in the district. There were very few black students also in algebra, eighth grade algebra, compared to the white students. And I wondered, how could the Office for Civil Rights have no findings of discrimination, even if it was not overt discrimination, if the data is just so obviously showing that there might be a problem there? And so I went to Bryan, Texas, and I stood out for a couple weeks. I stood outside of a lot of different schools, handing out flyers, talking to every parent who drove by. Just saying, you know, there was a Obama started this federal investigation to discrimination in your school district. Have you ever experienced anything? I want to hear your story. Hmm. And one mother reached out to me, Wyvola Polk, and she told me this horrific, depressing story about how her daughter was in art class in a class called Texas Success, and they were using popsicle sticks to decorate their hallway. And her daughter, Travesia, put hot glue on a popsicle stick, and, you know, the teacher wasn't looking. They were horse playing around with the popsicle sticks. And she ended up, by mistake, accidentally striking another classmate, which left him with a 2-inch hot glue burn. He went to the nurse's office. They bandaged it up. There was no emergency services. His family did not press charges. Yet, that school sent Travesia to jail. She was arrested that day. She's a 13-year-old girl in seventh grade. This happened in a Texas Success or like homeroom art class, and she was sent to jail for this incident. She cried the entire way there. It was on a Friday afternoon. She had to spend the entire weekend there. Not only that, she had hair extensions. They cut off her hair extensions. They put her in prison garb or juvenile detention garb, and they left her there for 3 days until her court date on Monday morning, in which she was told that she would no longer be able to go back to her school. She would have to go to a separate disciplinary alternative school for weeks. And so
This is outrageous. Wait, I just want to stop you 1 second. So general horseplay that we are all, quote unquote, guilty of as children. Kid gets burned, gets bandaged up, everything. The parents don't press charges. Right. So how is Travesia even arrested?
Well,
don't you have to have charges?
Right. according to the police, you know, the police said that, oh, this is not the school's responsibility to decide if a child's arrested. The police will. And they can decide if it's an assault, if it's just reckless engagement. So even though it might not have been intentional, because it was perhaps reckless, they could still arrest her and take her to the juvenile detention facility.
So they've criminalized childhood.
I mean, what this says to Travesia and her family is that, you know, even if it was an accident, that the school's not going to listen to her, right? That there's no way to ameliorate the situation. There's no way to come back from that situation. But what also haunts me in reporting this story is, what does this say to her classmates as well? What does this say to other Black students in Bryan, Texas, and other Black students in her middle school? And also, what does this say to the other white students, Hispanic students that are there? In a way, this then criminalizes the Black students that are already there. And so even if the students don't think that there's any difference, which they shouldn't, they might start to think with some kind of implicit bias mm-hmm. that there is.
And correct me if I will tell the listener, the little boy who was burned is a boy of color.
Right, right.
And the reason why his parents didn't want to press charges was...
Well, it's hard to say why they didn't. They just said they didn't know it was a she said situation. It could have been horseplay. It could have not been horseplay, but they didn't. But in fact, what they did tell me when I asked, well, has your child ever experienced any kind of discriminatory treatment? And they said, oh, yes, our son was actually pegged as a troublemaker, and we believe that it might have been due to his skin color. And so, you know, even it's not necessarily, you know, white students and Black students fighting. I mean, this is so entrenched in our system, so entrenched in America that it crosses color lines, even this kind of discrimination.
Well, then, so poor Trevasia, she's 13 years old. She's arrested, has to spend the weekend in jail. Mm-hmm. Has her, I think you said, had her extensions cut off. Mm-hmm. What rights do students like her have in a situation like that?
Well, you know, it's... The other very depressing thing about this is this, you know, her family is not, they don't have resources. Mm-hmm. They're by no means wealthy. So even, you know, if, you know, some family in the suburbs who has money, if this happened to their child, they might hire a lawyer that day and figure out a way to get their child out of there, right? Or it might not even happen to their child in the first place. But, you know, if you don't have money for a lawyer, for somebody who understands how to navigate the tricky legal landscape of juvenile detention facilities, it can be very difficult to understand what your rights are and understand how to protect them.
I'm just sort of blown away by what seems to be like the heartlessness of the adults in this school. A 13-year-old going to jail for the weekend, but it boggles the mind. You write in your article. Well, before we go to that, can you talk? You said she went to an alternative school for weeks. How is the alternative school different from her, you said it's a Texas success?
A normal school. So across America, and my lovely colleague Heather Vogel has done a lot of reporting on alternative schools. There are these schools which are separate than the traditional school, separate campus, separate teachers, even separate actual classwork. And students are sent here if they have some kind of disciplinary issue or they act out too many times. And what happens when you get sent here is you have, you know, a uniform, at least in Bryan, Texas. You're put in front of a computer. You're not really given one-on-one teacher time. You're not given the same schoolwork you would have. So a lot of these students fall drastically, deeply behind in their schoolwork. So when they come back into the traditional school after several weeks, they're behind. They can't catch up. And maybe they will act out more.
Mm-hmm.
And so this essentially spirals children into the school-to-prison pipeline, right? When we talk about push-out, it's not just that students are getting expelled. It's that there are these cascading effects that happen in each step that pushes these children further and further from not only academic achievement, but also just success in their mm-hmm. life, not falling into the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Who funds the alternative schools?
The alternative schools are funded pretty much by the school district and oftentimes by the state.
All right, back to what you wrote. You wrote, 3 decades ago, schools across the country began bolstering discipline to deter juvenile crime. Zero tolerance policies were introduced. School law enforcement budgets swelled, and suspensions, expulsions, and student arrests multiplied. So I guess this goes back to the beginning of this whole conversation of when it became okay to criminalize children, and particularly Black children. I mean, this is a natural extension of the war on drugs?
Yeah.
Does it go hand in hand, or is this something that happened in parallel?
I think it happened in parallel, but You know, it's hard to look at education in America without understanding our deep history of segregation of schools, right? You know, Brown v. Board happened in 1954, and schools were ordered to integrate, but that did not happen in 1954. If you look at school districts across the country, there are still tens, dozens, which are under desegregation orders today, some of them lasting over 30 or 40 years. The effects of segregated schools permeate our educational system, and you'll find even today, while a school might appear on its face integrated, if you look at the classes inside, if you look at the discipline inside, there's intra-school segregation. There are two tracks. There are tracking programs. So even though, you know, the resurgence of the surging school disciplinary system really came out of the 80s and early 90s, these tracking, these two lives, these two school lives, that started decades, centuries before.
Brian has a history of resistance, school integration resistance, right?
Right. So in 1954 was Brown v. Board, when all schools across the country were ordered to integrate. But it took Brian numerous years. They didn't fully integrate their schools until 1971. And this only happened when the school district built a high school that all students were supposed to attend. They had tried different integration techniques before, saying, oh, it's a open choice. Anyone can go to school wherever they want. And even though black students went to the white schools, no white students went to the black school. And so it wasn't until they kind of forced the integration with the building, the construction of a new school, that it actually happened. And that really shows the resistance to integration in our country. I mean, even when people think, oh, we're integrating, oh, we have an integrated school, you start to look at the different, you know, fragments of it. Mm-hmm. And you start to see that even today, there are still fragments of segregation left over.
So they built a brand new high school to force everyone into the same building. But as you just said, in the building, they had intra-school,
right,
intra-school segregation. Let's talk about D'Angelo, D'Angelo Rawlins from 2010.
He's really the one that sparked the civil rights investigation. So what happened was Marjorie Rawlins was a mother from Maryland. She moved to Texas. She put her son in school. He complained about being bullied. And she said, you know what? Tell the teacher. That's what I would do. Just tell the teacher. And the teacher told her son, you know, here in Texas, we don't tattle. And so next time he was bullied, he fought back. And under the school's zero tolerance approach, what happened was that he got a misdemeanor C ticket, a ticket from a police officer in school, which meant that he would have to go to adult court and, you know, possibly have community service, possibly pay a $500 fine. And Marjorie, you know, looking around at the court, saw all the black and brown kids there and no white kids really. And she said, this has got to stop. I have got to look into this. So she got on the internet. You know, this is like supermom getting on the internet, being like, I'm going to investigate this on my own time. She reached out to the NAACP. She reached out to Texas Appleseed, big organization that focuses on advocacy in schools in Texas. And she brought them all together and said, how are we going to make this change? And they got some data together and started looking into these tickets. And they found that it disproportionately affected students of color, just like Marjorie Rawlins thought. So they ended up filing this complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, which actually spurred on this investigation in Brian. And even though the ticketing has since subsided, as we've already spoken about, other disciplinary forms are still largely in place.
And they still sort of in, which disciplinary forms are still in place?
So, for example, the suspensions after they got rid of the tickets, they largely, you know, got rid of them because legislators, when they heard about this, were a little bit shocked that it affected students of color so disproportionately. And so they decided to make it tougher for police officers to give out tickets in the school. But after they got rid of the ticketing, for the most part, what happened was suspensions went up. And referrals to the disciplinary school went up. So even though you get rid of one disciplinary tactic, the other ones come more into play.
Well, in-school suspensions were up nearly 22% in 2016 in Bryan. You know what? Why were Texas officials shocked that this was happening? Is the state not monitoring its own schools?
That's a good question. I mean, these are, you know, legislators. Maybe there was some political game there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when you start to hear parent stories, when you start to hear, you know, when parents speak out, when families speak out, you start to hear the effects on their children, the long-term effects on their children. I think it's hard not to be moved by that. I think it's hard not to understand what's going on. And, you know, we can talk about policy all we want. We can talk about Betsy DeVos and Washington, D.C. and all the changes which are happening there. But at the end of the day, it's really, you know, the stories of these families that is most important for people to hear.
Yeah, and the trauma.
Right.
I mean, it's not just being arrested. It's the trauma that follows these children and their families for years.
Exactly.
If not for forever in their lives. We have to come back to Treveja and her mother, Wyvola Polk, because Wyvola did what any parent would do when her child gets into some kind of trouble. She went to the school.
Right.
To advocate for her child.
Right. And this was even before the incident in the Texas Success art class.
Oh.
This was a year before the incident with the hot glue burn. Her daughter was being bullied. And like, as you say, like any parent, you go to the school. You check in. You say, why is my daughter being bullied? And she went five or six times. And, you know, after the fifth or sixth time when nothing happened, they didn't stop the bullying at all. She had an outburst. You know, she gave them a tongue lashing. She said, you know, I'm going to sit outside the school and protect my daughter if you can't. And after that, they sent a police officer to her house to give her a citation, a warning citation, for trespassing. And this was shocking to me, you know, imagine this happening in, say, the suburbs of New York City or New Jersey.
Wow, Upper West Side, come on.
Right.
Yeah, that, how you were able to maintain your composure and write this is beyond me. You know, we had a caller called in, said her son works as a paraprofessional in a public school, assigned to a very troubled child who's just not going to classes. This is the other side of the coin, she feels, that the child isn't being served there, even though attempts being made. I mean, that to me, tell me what you think, but that to me sounds like there's more going on with this child than just not liking school.
Yeah, there are definitely children who have lots of problems and, you know, behavioral problems that need to be addressed in other ways, right? And you know, first of all, I'd like to thank her son for the work that he does. I think it's great that he's working in the school. And there's a lot of research right now on positive behavioral techniques in order to help encourage students not using discipline, but just encourage good behavior instead of just disciplining bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And research has found that that actually works. I mean, in this case, it sounds like there may be more going on, but there's a lot of research about how can we turn the coin? How can we change the entrenched disciplinary system that we have of more positive reinforcement?
Since we have a minute left, let's end with Treveja, because we started this part of the interview with her. So this whole horrible thing happens. She goes to this alternative school. She comes back to Texas Success, and she underwent a second hearing for due process once she returned to school.
Well, so what happened was, after she got out of the disciplinary school, she comes back into the regular school and gets in a scuffle because she, you know, people.
Oh, so this is for a different event.
Totally different event. And then she gets sent back to the disciplinary school for more time. And now she might be held back a year because her grades have fallen. And she's depressed and she's upset with herself and her family's upset. But they just feel like there's nothing they can do. You know, they feel like the system is working against them. The system is weighing down on them. And this just brings up, again, as a final thought, you know, that these are systemic issues. These are not individual issues. These are systemic issues which affect schools across America. And the data shows it. Personal stories show it. So we have to question, you know, what is our government doing to address it?
And what is our government doing to address it? Under the Obama administration, they were proactively trying to do something about it. But now with Secretary DeVos?
It's a question mark. So we'll have to see. But there are hints that she's going to roll back a lot of the tactics and the approach of the Obama administration.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with ProPublica reporter Annie Waldman about her latest investigation titled Betsy DeVos is Making It Easier for Schools to Send Black Kids Like This 13-Year-Old Girl to Jail. Annie, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.